This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the Climate Justice Tribunal.
We're all drowning or being killed by oil. Today we'll hear from three activists who returned from Cochabamba and are going to talk about the threat we all face.
Stay with us.
Michael Ratner, you know that Reverend Lucius Walker died on September 7th, the head of Pastors for Peace. You had worked closely with Lou Walker over the years, and I wanted to ask you about your remembrances of Lou.
We worked with Lou for a long, long time at the Center for Constitutional Rights. We represented him, if you want to call him that, and represented Pastors for Peace for years as the government tried to come down on him for going to Cuba, in their view, illegally, and for taking humanitarian aid, taking computers, taking other kinds of materials to Cuba that were for humanitarian reasons as a basis for breaking the blockade. And what was most interesting about Lou is Lou never gave up. There were points when the government said they're going to seize all his bank accounts. He didn't care. He was never, ever willing to cooperate with the government in any way. He just said, this is my right. I'm doing it. And somehow, even though we at the center were, I can't say more conservative is in the right way, but said, Lou, you know, they're going to take all your assets, they're going to do everything, they're going to take everything. He prevailed constantly. Every year or two or more than that, he would take huge caravans of aid to Cuba, and the government would keep saying, we're going to take everything away, we're going to stop you at the border, and he would just sit at the border until he got that stuff through. The guy was, I mean, he could have gone to jail for years, and he never, never gave in.
And how many years did he take medicine and other things to Cuba?
It had to be, I mean, as long as my memory, 20, 30, more maybe. So Cuba was a huge part of what Pastors for Peace did, which was he was a pastor, Reverend Lou Walker. It was an offshoot of an organization he ran called IFCO, which was in New York. Pastors for Peace was really one of the main activities that Lou did, but it wasn't the only one. I mean, we worked with Lou in Nicaragua, and Lou had the misfortune of being, on one of the trips, the person who got shot by the Contras. He's taking a boat down the, I think it's called the Rio San Juan, to the east coast of Nicaragua, and it goes in through a jungle. It looks like, you know, some huge jungle scene, and there's shots from the side, and he gets actually shot in the rear. You know, it didn't hurt him real badly, but it was a bullet wound through his buttock. So Lou never gave up. He just kept going and kept getting aid to Nicaragua. I went to Nicaragua with him a couple of times. And so Lou was somebody who, you know, when I saw that he had died, couldn't believe it because I thought he was much younger. He always acted like he was much younger. But his real thing was, to me, was that he just said he had a right to do this to Cuba. And it showed me that if you really push, in the end, the government, because he had so much force behind him as these reverends and all these people at the border with all this stuff, that they could never go after him. So he'll be sorely missed by all of the progressive communities, but particularly, I think, by the Cubans. He's a friend of Fidel's. He gave a speech, I think it was Lou, who Fidel invited him to give one of the May 1st speeches, which was interesting, a number of years ago, you know, May Day in Cuba. And he got up and he, very close to Fidel, there's many pictures of him and Fidel, and he denounced the death penalty. He said, look, I'm very big solidarity with Cuba. I do everything, obviously. I take my own life in my hands, but I don't believe that there should be a death penalty. And interestingly, Fidel responded afterwards by saying, look, I agree with you in principle that we shouldn't have a death penalty. Whether one accepts this or not, the circumstances that we're in, he says, are ones that we still need on very rare occasions to use the death penalty. Lou disagreed with him, but it just showed that Lou could disagree with Fidel, but at the same time be in complete solidarity with the Cuban Revolution.
We say presente for Lou Walker. We're at least grateful that Gail Walker is here and carrying on his work in spirit here at BAI.
No, it's true. IFCO and Pastors for Peace will continue, and he's a real hero, as you're pointing out, Michael.
Michael, there's a new court decision that rules on the issue of when offering a drink of water is a crime. What's your take on this?
Well, we're bringing this, I think, to people's attention for two reasons. One, because it has to do with immigration and refugees in Mexico and the border, but it also has to do with Jay Bybee. Jay Bybee is a judge on the Ninth Circuit, which is an appeals court, one of the major appeals courts in the United States, and he was, of course, the infamous author of the torture memos, or one of the authors of the torture memos, in which he basically said the words for torture and abuse are too vague and you can't really tell what they are, and therefore waterboarding and things like that are outlawed as torture. Well, the case that came before them, when is offering a drink of water a crime, was a case in which a group called No More Deaths, that's No More Deaths, that operates in Arizona, goes through and leaves gallon jugs of water in various places so that refugees who are dying, really dying, can get a drink of water. And they left a bunch of these in a national park. And as they were leaving them, a National Parks police pulls up behind them and says, you know, what you're doing here is littering, and I'll shorten the whole explanation, but you're littering by leaving these water bottles, and I want you to go pick them up. Now, these guys are tough guys, the No More Deaths, and as they knew they were being followed by the cops about picking up the water bottles, they, of course, unveil a huge sign that says No More Deaths on the back of their truck, and they fail to pick up all the water bottles. And they get charged under a parks regulation of a misdemeanor for littering. The parks regulation prohibits littering, and it's a criminal statute. And they go to a trial, and they get convicted at the lowest district court of littering. It goes to the Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit, and 2-1, the court says, the word littering does not mean leaving bottles of water for people who are going to starve or die from a lack of water. That's not the meaning. The word is too vague for people to tell that that would have been criminal conduct. There's vagueness in this word littering. And therefore, the conviction was reversed 2-1, and the people got off. Now, what's interesting about the case is the dissent was written by Jay Bybee, the infamous Jay Bybee, who wrote the torture memos, who said the word torture is too vague. He did not think the word littering was too vague to give people notice that dropping off water bottles would be littering. That sounds pretty vague to me, dropping off water bottles being littering. But Bybee said, no, littering has a clear meaning. And in this case, whether you use the word in the statute garbage or littering, it's not vague. And the people knew that what they were doing was violating a criminal statute. So here's a guy who, when it comes to torture, said this is too vague to prosecute anybody for torture, and you can allow almost anything. But when it comes to dropping off water bottles to give people to survive, he says the word littering is not too vague, and the people should have known that littering included the dropping off of gallon jugs of water to save refugees coming across the border. It seems like every day we're hit with another man-made disaster, such as the BP oil catastrophe, Katrina, floods in Pakistan. The People's Council of Climate Justice are pushing for a structure of accountability. In April, the People's World Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth in Cochabamba, Bolivia, brought together 30,000 activists and indigenous people. Our guest today attended that conference. We're joined by activists Jeff Jones, Michael Johnson, and Monique Hardin. Michael, a Bronx activist, helped lead the U.S. delegation in Bolivia and delivered reports to Evo Morales and Hugo Chavez. Monique is the co-director and attorney for Advocates for Environmental Human Rights in New Orleans. She began defending the rights of those most impacted by the Gulf disaster and now the BP disaster. Monique has seen the effects of climate change firsthand. We welcome the three of them to this important show on climate change, Cochabamba, the Bronx, and Bolivia. Michael Johnson and Jeff Jones, we just want to talk about the Brecht Forum and what's happening on September 18th. We know both of you guys were actually roommates in Cochabamba, and it's all about climate change and what to do about it. But why don't you give us, Michael, start with you, a little bit about what's going to happen on September 18th at the Brecht Forum.
On the 18th of September, we'll have a conference inviting guests, Ambassador to Bolivia to the United Nations, Pablo Salón. We're also having Miguel Descoto, previous president of the United Nations General Assembly, Monique Harding from New Orleans, who has worked there immensely with climate change issues and also issues around the Gulf oil spill. We also having Tanya Fields, who works out of the Bronx and doing a great deal of environmental justice work.
And you're going to be there as well.
I will. I'll be there as well as a facilitator.
No, it sounds remarkable. It's called From Bolivia to the Bronx and Beyond, a People's Climate Justice Council. You've given us an amazing rundown of people who are going to be there, but what is a People's Climate Justice Council or a People's Justice Climate Council? I guess you can say either one, Michael, but tell us a little bit about what it is.
Well, we're trying to bring together not only people that are involved in environmental justice work and climate justice work, and also very key people around, like, for instance, Ambassador Solon, who helped significantly in presenting the People's Accord to the United Nations and to the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, was the finalization of our work in Bolivia. So we're trying to bring together professionals or people who have been intricately involved in the process of bringing together a People's Accord to communicate what our next steps are, what are the main issues, where do we go from here, and strategic actions.
The reason there was a People's Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth called in Cochabamba, Bolivia, was because of the failure of the UN negotiations in Copenhagen last December. And at that conference, there was no agreement but the developed world did not agree to any definitive cuts in carbon emissions. And so people from the global south and from the developing world who are being threatened by the impact of climate change, led by Bolivian President Evo Morales, called us together in Cochabamba, Bolivia in April to talk about what we could do from a different perspective, to create a different political focus in the world, an international movement. And so this event that we're doing at the Brecht Forum on Saturday evening, the 18th of September from 6 to 9 p.m., is our attempt in New York City to carry forward the work of the Cochabamba Conference and the People's Accord, which came out of it.
And I believe the reason why President Morales thought of the idea is because the citizens and the communities of our country and of the planet had no real voice in. He wanted to make sure that the people who actually this would mostly affect, the people of the earth, would have an opportunity to voice their opinion and come together and put together some sort of a document that they would feel comfortable with since they were not involved.
We were in Cochabamba. Is this beautiful Andean city. It's at an altitude of about 8,200 feet, surrounded by huge, beautiful mountains. It was coming toward the end of the Andean summer. Still, where does Cochabamba get its water? Mainly from melting glaciers. There wasn't a melting glacier in sight. They were all gone. And so this is just one example of what the climate crisis is doing to people in Bolivia. There's going to be a water crisis, and the Bolivians know that, and they were reaching out for some international solidarity and help, you know, before these intractable problems overwhelm the people of Bolivia and other countries like that. So that was the starting point. And then what we have to do is figure out how to take the lessons that we learned there and apply them right here in our own communities in New York City.
It's called From Bolivia to the Bronx and Beyond. I understand the Bolivia part because you guys were just in Bolivia. I understand, as we'll later hear in the show, having someone from New Orleans. And I know you're from the Bronx, but
Correct.
It's got to be more than the fact that Michael Johnson is from the Bronx, that's in the title of the talk.
Definitely. And I think why the Bronx was incorporated into the title was because of some of the Bronx has some of the worst air quality in the country, definitely in the city, and the highest asthma rates. And that is a direct reflection on some of the problems that are happening all over the world. So bringing the title of Bolivia to the Bronx is kind of brings a full circle of how it affects all of us. We just recently fought in the Bronx to stop a major highway, Highway 87, from being expanded, the Major Deegan, which would have increased our poor air quality and probably increased the asthma rates in our community. So we want to make that a full circle, showing how everyone's involved or affected by what happens to our climate.
Jeff Jones, Michael Johnson, when you were in Cochabamba, what kind of discussions were there about what people back at a local level could get involved doing?
That's a great question, Michael. And there were a lot of those discussions. We were approaching it from a number of different aspects. There was the question of what each one of us should do in our own the way we live our lives in relation to the generation of carbon pollution and the causes of global warming. But mostly, we were talking at the national and international level. This was really an international conference. Governments were represented. Organizations were represented from around the world. So our main focus there was, how do we build a movement that will force our government here in the United States to take meaningful action in terms of addressing the problem of climate? What are the kinds of policies, what are the kinds of investments we can make that will result in transforming the way we live our lives and the way we do business? The green jobs idea, the idea that we can rebuild our economy in a post-fossil fuel world. That's something we talk about here. But when you're in a place like Bolivia, then you're beginning to see what life can be like for people on a massive scale if we don't solve those problems. So those were the kinds of discussions that we were having down there. I mean, there were over 30,000 people in this little university town called Tiquipaya, which is a suburb of Cochabamba. And there were many, many workshops and interest groups, things going on all the time. So there were a lot of different voices, and there were a lot of different ways to express them.
Now, one thing that came out of this was something that I know you guys have been mentioning on and off as I've seen you, but International Climate Justice Tribunal. And, of course, I being a lawyer, an international lawyer in particular, I think, well, we already have the International Criminal Court. We have the International Court of Justice at The Hague. We have all kinds of international courts. So is this another court? What is the International Criminal Justice Tribunal? And according to the notes you guys sent me, that you actually began preliminary hearings in 7 cases. So tell me what's going on here.
I'll be honest with you. I can't speak to the preliminary hearings. I'm not a lawyer. That's really the reason that Father Miguel Descoto is coming to the event. He's headlining the event on the 18th at the Brecht Forum. Father Miguel is coming up from Managua, but he spent the previous year here in New York City as the president of the UN General Assembly. And as you know, at the end of his term as president of the UN General Assembly, he was not a happy man. He was really, for many different reasons, extremely upset at the way the UN is organized and the lack of power that the General Assembly has in relation to the Security Council. It's basically a toothless organization. So he has a vision for how the UN should be reorganized. And included in that vision is this idea of an international tribunal on climate. And it would be a court that would look at what the developed world has done in terms of things like carbon pollution and what is the impact on the developing world. And then it would actually take meaningful action and require the aid that the developed world owes to the developing world. How we will get that implemented, that's on the agenda for our meeting on the 18th. That's why Father Miguel is flying up from Managua to join us. And certainly part of our thinking is that here we are in New York City, home to the United Nations. If anybody at the grassroots level is going to support a global climate justice tribunal, let's do it here in New York City, where we can go down to the UN and stand outside and hold up signs and chant and meet with people and tell them this is something that we think is needed.
It's quite evident that the forces that are perpetuating the climate disaster have prevailed in terms of confusing and miseducating public opinion as to the urgency of the situation. And I wonder how people like us can get out the message of science that we really are in a catastrophic situation with time running out.
Well, I think we have to be re-educated. I think we had, with the past administration, presidential administration here in our country, of course, the Bush administration disqualified any scientific data, saying that it was not accurate, it's not man-made, that our climate warms on its own, and it's nothing that we can really do about it. And it's nothing that corporations or our governments can do to fight that. So I think what we have to do is to re-educate our public. We don't have to be scientists, but we have to have some information, and that's what we're trying to do now, inform the public about exactly what we're heading for and what does it mean to go up 1 degree Celsius. Why are we fighting for so many like strategic marks and benchmarks so we don't exceed what our planet can take on without us having survival?
We take the subways for granted. We take our public transportation system for granted. We use it all the time. But I'm not sure how many people realize, maybe everyone knows this, that 1/3 of all public transit trips that take place in the country, in the United States every day, take place in New York City. This is the most energy efficient city in the country.
I heard this somewhere, but I didn't remember it. It's
actually
very important
to
bring that up.
It's very interesting because, of course, we look at the subways and we're all filled with criticisms and problems. But
I love the subway.
Here's where the issue comes in is the cutbacks. The cutbacks to the public transit system will lead to increased climate pollution. It will cost people jobs. It will make life harder for the people living in the outer boroughs, because that's where the cuts are taking place, and it will increase climate pollution. So it's a lifestyle, green jobs, climate change reduction issue that affects us every day here in the New York City metropolitan area. And there's a transportation justice movement. Some of their representatives will be with us at the meeting at the Brecht Forum to talk about how do we approach transportation policy in a way that we understand its impact not only on the way we live our lives every day, but the impact on the world as a whole.
Now, Michael Johnson, it says, I understand that you led the U.S. delegation to Cochabamba.
Actually, I didn't.
Oh, okay. Well,
I went to Cochabamba to learn and became nominated to be a president of Harmony with Nature Working Group.
Harmony with Nature Working Group.
Right.
Okay.
There are 17 working groups, and maybe Jeff could expound on some of the others. I became nominated to be president of the working group Harmony with Nature and Living Well because I felt that working group was something that that was really part of what I've always believed in, that we need to be as citizens of the planet in harmony with our planet and with nature. So I became president. I was voted in pretty outstandingly from about 300 people participating in that.
From all over the world.
From all over the world.
Wow.
Some presidents, some mayors of Mexico, some indigenous leaders throughout South America. And I had no idea that they would actually vote for me for whatever reason. It worked out where we were able to come together and put out a real document.
Yeah, what did you do? What was the document? I know you made a presentation to President Morales and
Correct.
President Chavez.
Correct.
But tell us what the document, what'd you say, what'd you do?
Well, before the presentation to the presidents, we came together in that room in our working group to put together a document of a conscious thought of how we could move forward with harmony with nature. 300 people came together after only working on the document for 3 days. And, of course, it's hard to get 25 people, maybe five people, to walk across the street in one direction. So to actually bring together 300 people to walk in one unison or one common thought, it was quite amazing for everyone involved. So after that took place, and we had a plenary and where we put together our final document to all of the participants of the conference, some 30,000 people and about 126 nations were represented or countries. I was asked by Pablo Solon, the ambassador to the United Nations for Bolivia, to present the Harmony with Nature Working Group and four other working groups' final conclusive document to President Morales, President Chavez, and about 17 different heads of state and representatives from countries around the world, which was, again, quite astounding to have that opportunity and honor.
What did you say in the document?
I had maybe 8 hours to put together concise thought of a three-minute speech on not only Harmony with Nature but the three other working groups to communicate what we pretty much put out. And far as Harmony with Nature, we concluded several different key topics of how we don't own our planet. Our planet sustains our life, and we have to work to protect our planet, which in turn protects our own lives.
Evo Morales, President, Bolivian President Morales, is the first indigenous person of the Americas elected to be president of a country. And he really carries that indigenous philosophy about harmony with nature, with Mother Earth, with him in his speeches. And it was embedded in the conference. The indigenous community of Bolivia turned out. They were participants in the conference, and they were everywhere at all the events that we went to. Food, music, the people, the clothes, the dances, everything. It was just an permeated everything that we did for the 6-7 days that we were down there. But the thing is that philosophy about living in harmony with the earth, respecting the earth, that the purpose of our lives is not to use up every resource that we can without thinking about the generations that come next. And that was the focus of his opening speech, which was really a wonderful speech, and it set the tone for the conference.
Using the earth is profitable. And that seems to me to be the crux of the problem. I've been reading a book that Jake Ratner gave me called Crack Capitalism, and the author John Holloway says that it's easier to envision the end of the earth than it is to envision the end of capitalism. And that seems to me, to put it quite succinctly, what we're talking about with catastrophic climate change is really the end of being able to live in harmony with nature as we have for how many tens of thousands of years. Was there any kind of discussion about how you rein in these profit makers?
There was plenty of discussion along those lines, and there was a very clear awareness at this conference started right from the beginning that there's a contradiction between the survival of the Earth and the expansionary nature of capitalism. Lots of people who were there were anti-capitalist, and Evo Morales talks about a political system in Bolivia of communitarian socialism. He doesn't say that that's what Bolivia has, but that's what his dream is for Bolivia. But that's where the respect for Mother Earth's rights comes in. What he laid out and what a lot of us picked up on there is we would like to live our lives in such a way that we have what we need to be comfortable, be happy, make sure our families are secure, our air is, we can breathe our air, we can drink our water. That's something that everybody has a right to. But we don't have to have more than that. And we don't have to be constantly, you know, having it in some new form just to keep generating more profit for somebody. So that was very much a consciousness of the conference. And it was reinforced by the indigenous people who were there. Our North American delegation was very strong with indigenous leadership, and they were specifically invited by the Bolivians to come and be a part of this and felt very much at home with the politics and the philosophy of the conference.
Well, the Mother Earth stuff is very interesting because that really comes out of an indigenous culture. In Bolivia, yes. I was in Bolivia recently, and that's a very important part of the Bolivian culture is Mother Earth and what that's about. Definitely. But I'm interested in you were 30,000 people down there. Now you're sitting here in a studio in New York, and we know what's going on. You know, even this junky climate bill that they tried to get through the U.S. Congress never even made it through. And the question for both you guys and for the whole conference is, what are you guys going to do next? How's this going to happen? I mean, you know, you have this grouping here, which is a huge, major grouping of indigenous people and other peoples. And then you have all this, all the people who actually control our environment on the other side, at least in a certain way.
That's true.
And is there a plan? Is there a plan for another meeting? What's your plan for the next year? I mean, what's going to happen?
Well, what happened immediately after the conference, we came back to New York. The Bolivian mission invited some people down to their office where we came up with strategic actions of how to have our People's Accord incorporated into the negotiating text of Bonn.
Negotiating text of what?
Bonn was in Germany. That was a meeting set forth by the UNFCCC.
This is the follow-up process between Copenhagen, which took place last December, which we generally consider now to have been a failure, and the next global UN meeting, which is taking place in Cancun, Mexico, in early December of this year. Actually, the next 2 years' meetings have been set, Johannesburg and then Rio in 2013, to create a global climate treaty that will take the place of the Kyoto Accord, which expires at the end of 2012.
Correct.
So what Michael is talking about is the sub-meetings that have taken place, one in Bonn, Germany, another which is coming up in the next week or two in Beijing.
Right. These are all official UN meetings.
These are official UN meetings, but what has happened is that we have been able...
We were successful in integrating the People's Accord into the negotiating text for what's to happen in Cancun in December in terms of negotiating to change the Copenhagen Agreement to adapt some of the People's Accords
conclusions. Okay, now we're
conclusions.
On the People's Accord. I got
okay.
it.
Okay.
So I got it. You have all this UN stuff going on out there, and then you have the guys coming out of Cochabamba, the 30,000 people, and all of really, really what represents the people.
Right.
And you came up with a People's Accord. Actually, you guys were successful in getting this People's Accord put into at least some working document of the UN, which is quite important, I would
right.
say.
Right. Now, the document we're looking at or we're talking about is actually the Climate Tribunal, the Working Group on Climate Tribunal Justice, with following recommendations. So they have seven recommendations.
So this isn't really the People's Accord.
No, this is not the entire document.
This is part of it.
Okay. Part
this
of
is
it.
The Climate Justice
which was one of the 17 working groups.
Got it. Okay.
Like I mentioned before, Harmony with Nature, Strategic Actions, Forestation, Kyoto Protocol, so and probably 10 others, but there it was a comprehensive approach to addressing our issues and trying to come up with a comprehensive document or a consensus on the people coming together and what we see are our key issues. And we're planning on going in December to Cancun, those who can.
So Cancun is like a Copenhagen.
Yes.
It's a big UN conference.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
And your expectations are that you're going to actually be able to have some influence, at least.
Hopefully the people's thoughts and ideas will be heard and not just forced down our throats by our governments and corporations who pretty much control our governments.
And if we can't get into the discussions, and this happened to a lot of people who went to Copenhagen, then the expectation is that people will be in the streets.
What was the most exciting thing for either of you that happened in Bolivia?
I was also asked to speak in front of 40,000 people at the closing address.
Whoa.
And I only had maybe 10 minutes to prepare for it. So it was, that probably was the most interesting and exciting moment, next to coming up with a comprehensive document or a document that our working group put out that was very hard to do, but we all came together and moved forward. And that's, I think it's very powerful whenever people come together. And it really shows what we can do together, and that was the most important thing.
Right, Michael. And you, Jeff?
Well, for me, it was a magical cultural moment. We had it in our minds that we wanted to make sure and get good seats at the soccer stadium for the opening ceremony. So we caught a 6:30 bus from where we were staying over to this little field area in a town called Tiquipaya, and the bus led us off on this dusty, unpaved street without any directions. But a Bolivian indigenous band was starting to play beautiful flute music with an electric guitar backup, and we just followed the music through this village, and we found the soccer stadium as the sun was coming up over the Andes. It was a very beautiful moment. I'll never forget it.
Is there a website that our listeners can go to get more information on this?
Here you go, www.pwccc, pw3cs.worldpress.org takes you to what is a very good and very actively maintained website. Stuff going up there all the time.
Say it again.
PWCCC, pw3cs.worldpress.org. And if that doesn't work, just Google People's World Conference on Climate Change.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Monique, I understand you were in Cochabamba as well as our other people here, Michael and Jeff, and that something incredible happened the day you got to Cochabamba, that there was an oil spill, and it relates to where you live and what happened to you in Cochabamba. So tell us a little bit about what you were doing in Cochabamba, and then what you thought when you heard the oil spill and how this all relates to what the work was in Cochabamba.
Well, sure. You know, I live in New Orleans, Louisiana, and along with other environmental justice advocates from the state and around the country, we were part of a U.S. delegation to the World People's Conference on Climate Change in Cochabamba, Bolivia. And it was actually on the day that we were leaving Cochabamba on our way to the airport that a friend of mine, part of the environmental justice delegation, got the news story about an explosion of an oil rig in the Gulf near Louisiana. As you know, as his parting words is before the bus doors closed and we were off to the airport, he you know, relayed this to me. I'm thinking, oh my God, like, is it a big explosion? Is it a small explosion? And so it was about a day later that on arriving to New Orleans that, you know, I learned that 11 people had died who worked on the oil rig, that it was an oil rig under contract to BP. And the rest has been this real odyssey around the treatment of folks who have been put out of work, the posturing and position taken by some of our elected officials who just want to siphon money but not really restore or recover, and the complete unaccountability on the part of our federal government to, in the first end, prevent this from happening, but on the back end, not ensuring that people are able to recover. Right now, as we speak, there's a voluntary fund that was BP engineered, that's administered by one person, Kenneth Feinberg, and it's already having problems because of the nature of claims for people who are either worked on a cash basis or a subsistence fishermen and women in the Gulf. This need for documentation is blocking people's ability to be able to fully recover from this disaster, where the ability to go out and fish is still hampered because, you know, very little interest in the part of buyers because of the concerns of the fish being contaminated by the oil or the chemical dispersants used. It's an ongoing problem, even though it's no longer on national TV seeing this, you know, oil hemorrhaging from the Gulf of Mexico. The consequences for the people who have made this their home and have done this for generations, you know, still in limbo.
Attorney Monique Hardin, down there in New Orleans, can you tell us how you explain to people the connection between your being in Coach Obama and what they were trying to do there and the BP oil spill in the Gulf?
Well, the experience in Coach Obama was really incredible, to have people from around the world, you know, not large, you know, prominent people or elected officials or celebrities, but just average, everyday people who see that, who are already experiencing the effects of climate change, whether it's drought, hurricanes like what we've had in the Gulf region of the United States, or a huge population displacement, which is also part of our experience in the Gulf region after Hurricane Katrina and subsequent storms. But galvanizing around the point of what we can do as people to change this, what is it that we can do to ensure that, you know, our dependence on fossil fuels is changed and our ideas and habits around consumption are changed, because it's killing us. It's killing the people. It's killing people. It's killing our environment. And it's creating a very bleak future for us if we continue down this path. And so looking at very crystal clear practical steps around holding governments accountable, but also holding ourselves accountable in this process in terms of changing our habits, changing the ways in which we carelessly consume without thinking about what this means in terms of future generations that, you know, won't be able to sustain that kind of a lifestyle. Were all of the kinds of things flowing? One of the challenges I saw immediately, and even as we were leaving, was how am I going to deliver this message back in the United States, where climate change is a disputed topic, and, you know, there's this, you know, hoax about the science of climate change, and it, you know, this resistance to moving towards a more sustainable way of life. The BP explosion in some ways created an opportunity to really think harder than we have about these issues, because it was a very clear demonstration of what we're headed toward with the depletion of oil and natural resources, directing companies like BP to more dangerous and hazardous places to produce fuel, whether it's very deep water areas that are virtually almost hard to create safeguards for in the event of an accident or an explosion, or if it's the tar sands production that's going on in Canada. The dangers of this can't be ignored any longer. I think we've all got that message, and it's an opportunity around how do we change the current cycle and the current pattern that we've gotten ourselves into.
I know BP did give you that opportunity, and of course I'm interested, we're sitting here with Michael and Jeff, and I think you hit the nail on the head in a way, and you experienced in this is, how do you bring home to Americans who, you know, who basically ride on essentially almost other people's lives in the way they live, how do you bring it home? And I think to have our other guests join in here would be very important, Michael and Jeff. Monique asked a really interesting question,
definitely,
an important one.
Definitely. Well, I think one of the first things we tried to do, each person that came back and tried to do a report back to their own communities, explaining the importance of what happened in Cochabamba, what the importance of reducing our carbon emissions, to living differently, re-educating our people about what we can do to actually help our planet survive and how it is affecting our everyday lives. And in the Bronx, I was able to give a report back to our community board, who I had mentioned earlier, fought to stop major traffic or major highway from being expanded by the New York State Department of Transportation, which thought there was nothing wrong with doing that. But we have so many, we're totally surrounded by highways. That area was designated for green space, for waterfront access, which we have very little in New York City, and also, of course, in the Bronx, since it's a major industrial area in the South Bronx. We had to go back to our communities, talk to them about the importance of what we found out, what we learned, and how we can apply that to our own communities.
There was a lot of wonderful insights that I gained in Cochabamba, and meeting Michael and meeting Monique were also some of the high points. I have always had, for a long time, had great respect for the work that Monique has done in her organization, which advocates for environmental human rights in New Orleans. You know, Monique was telling the story about getting on the bus to go back to the airport in Cochabamba at the end of the conference and hearing about the explosion in the Gulf. And when she told me that, I went back and checked the dates. And if I'm not mistaken, Monique, the actual explosion took place on the 20th, which was the actual day, first day of the conference. So as we were sitting there in that soccer stadium in Tiquipaya listening to Evo Morales and others kick off the conference, that was the moment when the explosion was taking place.
That's right.
And so to me, it's kind of the irony is tragic, but also revelatory. This was a well that was dug deep into the earth, a mile down in the Gulf of Mexico, to feed our fossil fuel habit so that we can continue to live a fossil fuel-based and oil-based lifestyle that is just not sustainable. And that's what took people's lives there. And the only other thing I'll say about it right now about the experience in Cochabamba is that the New York delegation that we run was mostly people from communities. These are not people whose relationship to the environment is the traditional one, which I'm a part of, protecting land and saving habitats and watching the birds, all things that everyone knows I love to do. But this is about the environment, the impact of the environment on people who sometimes are at war with the environment because the environmental hazards have been dumped into people's neighborhoods. That's the South Bronx.
Correct.
That's parts of Brooklyn. That's what the environmental justice movement is fighting, and that's who the New York delegation was in Cochabamba. So that when we talk about the people changing the way they live their lives as one of the things that has to happen in relation to controlling the climate crisis, certainly the people who are in Cochabamba were the are people who are not the not the ones who are responsible for most of the carbon emissions in our society. The mainstream environmental movement, which was not represented in Cochabamba, which I participate in quite a bit, nevertheless had put all its money on a federal strategy, on the passage of a bill in Congress. And that strategy has now failed. There will not be a bill passed by this government, by this Congress, that will address climate. So we're going to have to deal with the problem as at the state level and at the local level.
Well, you know my thinking about this, Jeffrey. I of course,
I do know your
can't
thinking.
Stand the federal government. I hate anything you've go to Congress on is ridiculous. It's ridiculous, at least if you took saw what it took to get the civil rights movement passed. It took Martin Luther King being murdered.
Exactly.
So until there's a huge grassroots movement, which is why I think the emphasis on communities and grassroots and local level is where to not necessarily begin, but it's certainly a crucial part of anything because these guys in Congress, it's like they're all on the payroll of somebody. So I think the big environmental organizations, just like the big civil rights organizations, make a mistake when they go directly to Washington. That's just, you know. But anyway, Monique, you can say chime in here if you want.
Well, you know, I think the thing that, you know, makes me blow a gasket is that there is so much awareness and intellect behind the consequences of climate change and large-scale disasters on the lives of people. There are volumes of reports and policies at the federal level, but there's this huge disconnect or resistance to moving that information into action. And so instead we quarrel, we debate, we delay. I think one of the things that, you know, is a challenge in terms of moving this at local and state levels, especially for those of us in the Gulf region and Texas and Louisiana in particular, is the reliance that is historical reliance that we have in the states on the companies that profit from oil production, oil and gas production, notwithstanding the ruinous effects which are plain to see in the landscape. I mean, in Louisiana, for example, we have 5 historic African-American communities that no longer exist, Morrisonville, Revilletown, Sunrise, Diamond, and Bel Air, because of the toxic pollution and exposures on residents. So, you know, the history, the culture, the social networks that were there, it's, you know, it's all been displaced, dislocated as a result of this kind of industry that we've got in the state that our elected officials, you know, continue to cater to and see as the lifeblood for the economy of both Texas and Louisiana. While the federal government has its challenges, when you look at the places where oil production is concentrated, there are even greater challenges.
And Monique, your plans now, I know you're coming to New York for the September 18th forum. Is that the main reason you're coming, or is there other work that you have to do here as well?
No, that is the main reason. One of the things that we would like at Advocates for Environmental Human Rights to do is to build better connections and relationships with the folks in New York around the advocacy for rights-based recovery, whether it's from environmental injustice and racism or climate change. It's got to be, or like a BPOL disaster, there has to be an obligation to remedy the damage caused. And that needs to be based on the individual rights, which we connect with fundamental human rights that our government has an obligation to uphold for each and every one of us. So the situation in particular with environmental justice communities in New York, as well as the people who were harmed by the Bush administration's Environmental Protection Agency on the toxic air that they were exposed to after 9/11, are folks that we'd like to meet and talk through with about this idea of around a rights-based recovery and see where that can go.
So you're going to be here for more than just the forum, is that it?
That's right.
That's great. Each of you, the three of you, have been in Coach Obama. Give us your final thoughts.
Michael, what the feedback has been from the communities that he's engaged with about the Coach Obama experience?
I think they are very excited, and they still are. Of course, the BP oil spill, like you said, was an opportunity to teach. When there's no reason to change, or there's no reason to look at anything differently, people continue to move on with their lives and don't think there's no reason to do anything differently. But that gave us an opportunity to teach, and people in our community now have, they see the results to, I guess, our excess of using our natural resources causing our demise. In our community, or in South Bronx, we have quite a few grassroots activist organizations that work pretty hard at educating the populace and our communities to do things differently and giving them feedback on what we're doing, trying to move this issue forward.
Following up on Monique, Michael, what's the most kind of questions or resistance that you got to people? Don't we just need more oil? Don't we need cheaper oil? I mean, what was the kind of resistance? I know you're giving us the positive part, but wasn't there, you have to persuade people sometimes.
Well, I think the most prevalent question was, is it really man-made in terms of our entire global climate issue and change of a climate? I mean, this being one of the hottest summers ever and probably in the United States history that's been recorded, I don't think it was hard to make that argument. So that was one of the first key questions. Is it really our fault? What can we really do to make a difference as individuals, not as collective bodies? And I think any true change will have to happen on an individual basis, how we live our lives, how we consume petroleum products, how we distribute, or how do you get rid of our waste? Do we recycle? There's things that we've talked to our community about, how they can make a change in their own lives, but also to how they can stay tuned to gather more information on how these our various corporations affect our everyday lives that are the biggest polluters.
Were people open to that message? That's really what I mean, you know, because I was thinking, well, you know, so I take whatever I use, plastic packaging or how I don't recycle, and I'm looking at guys, you know, flying around in private jets and saying, why should I bother when these guys are wasting all the...
No, I think there was a true interest in the issue. It doesn't stop there with explaining to them what they should do, but I think it's been a steady outcry for change in our community to do things differently, and that's what it's going to take to actually have anything change and do anything differently. So they responded. They were more interested in all the people coming together in Bolivia? What did that mean? Why was certain leaders there? Was it a communist meeting? Was it about socialism? So no, it was about people to come together to change and better our own lives.
And Monique, your experience?
Well, you know, my experience has been pretty exhilarating in terms of not having to convince people in the Gulf region. We all know that there's no coherent plan or process to address it. With climate change, the effects of it, it means that children can be separated from parents. It means that families can no longer take care of themselves as they used to. It means that whatever your sense of normalcy was is ripped from under you. And people get that here in the Gulf region. What we have here is 5 years with five major disasters: Hurricanes Katrina, Rita, Gustav Eich, and the BP oil drilling disaster. So people really get the point that there is no plan, there is no process for you. You get the runaround, you get tied up in bureaucracy that is, you know, poorly funded and with no consideration of the real life impacts and toll that a disaster creates in a person's life. With a real focus on children and the turmoil that they go through displacement and having to undergo a disaster. So those parts, I think, people get really clearly. I think what's happening, though, in the Gulf region is, what the BP oil disaster has created is more of a sense of we can't continue to live like this anymore, that this is dangerous. And so then where things get a little bit mysterious is then, so what's the alternative and how do we move to that? And I think the fact that people are looking towards what this alternative could be and could look like is a good thing. But, you know, we don't have those answers readily available. But there is more interest now than ever around figuring this part out.
Well, thank you, Monique.
Thank you.
Thank you, Monique.
Thank you.
Good talking to you, Monique.
Y'all take care.
You too.
You know, I'll just add one point. Since before and after Cochabamba, a lot of my work has been in the labor movement, trying to win a perspective about how we can make economic progress and create green jobs in the post-fossil fuel economy. And I went to a labor leaders climate forum meeting not too long ago that also had as a theme building the dialogue between the labor movement and the environmental justice movement. Besides the work that I do with the New York State Apollo Alliance, I also am on the board of directors of We Act for Environmental Justice, which is a Harlem-based organization. And there were a number of people from the labor movement there, but one person who just knocked me out was Priscilla Gonzalez, who is the executive director of Domestic Workers United. And here in New York, there actually was a good thing that the New York State Legislature did, which was pass the Domestic Workers Bill.
Yeah, we know. I know Priscilla. We interviewed her on the show. She's fabulous.
She's unbelievable. Well, I want to tell you what she said about climate, because it was a knockout. Besides the fact that when she introduced herself going around the table, she said, "Well, I represent what will soon be a union of 200,000, you know, mostly women of color." A revelatory moment. But what she said at the end of the conference, she said, I came here to learn about the issue of climate. And climate doesn't directly impact Domestic Workers United members in a day-to-day way working in people's homes. She said, but most of the women who we represent come from or have families in the global south. And their families are profoundly impacted by climate. Their ability to raise crops, their ability to get access to good water, and the long-term, not-so-long-term fear of the creation of climate migrations, forced removal of people because of the collapse of ecosystems was very much on her mind. And she said, and for that reason, this is an important issue to our organization.
Of course, it was. New York State did finally pass a domestic workers bill, which it's historical. I mean, yeah. Domestic Workers United is just an incredible organization. So I'm glad that you brought those two together. And we want to thank you guys, first, for going to Cochabamba, secondly, for being active in your communities and bringing, really, this issue in a wonderful way to our listeners. So, Michael, I knew Lou, and I spoke a bit about him on the show. I know you worked even closer than I did with Lou, and you were very involved with him. So give us, I know, you know, his passing must have been very...
Right, on September 7th, we lost Reverend Lucius Walker, and came to a surprise to all involved, or all who had ever got, you know, maybe rubbed shoulders or felt his presence, which was quite amazing, as you know. I spent quite a few Thanksgiving dinners with him and his family, went on quite a few caravans and delegations with Pastors for Peace. Lucius Walker definitely was and will always be a mentor of mine. Of course, he practiced nonviolent civil disobedience in his protesting of inequalities in our community and abroad, and what our government does to other communities in the Global South and around the world. You know, just recently watching a movie of Gandhi for the second time reminded me a lot of Lou at that moment while watching it, and he hadn't even passed yet. And of course, Gandhi taught civil disobedience through nonviolent means. And of course, Lou attained and gained a great deal of freedoms and justice for people through nonviolent means. And I just want to thank his family. Our prayers are with his family. And just thank you, thank his family for sharing him with us, and what a blessing he's been to all of us who've been involved with pastors, done work around Cuba, who've done work around Chiapas, who've been involved in Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, who've done work with around Vieques and the bombing of Vieques by our own military. Lucius Walker has been instrumental in so many causes. Just recently, a major cause of his was helping a great deal of our people from our country be educated at the Latin American School of Medicine in Havana, that Fidel Castro gave our people an opportunity to be given a free scholarship to be educated at the Latin American School of Medicine, and Lou took that and helped a great deal of people become doctors and come back to our communities here in the United States to help where we need desperate help. So I just thank you for asking about Lucius. He means a lot to me and my family, and always will. And
well, thank you very much, Michael. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.